isn't about that. You don't want to admit it, but it is. No, it's not. You leave here, and you leave her, and you leave your memories, and leave all those dreams you had behind, and you finally let go. Fuck you, Leonard. She left you, you gotta leave her. Fuck you, Leonard. She did what she thought was right for her, you gotta do what's right for you. You respect her decision, and you know she'd respect your decision. Fuck you, Leonard. And if you don't leave, 10 years from now you're gonna look back and regret it. And you're gonna hate yourself for being a coward, and you're gonna hate Lily for keeping you here, and you know you'd fucked up and blew it. Fucking drop it, Leonard. I'll drop it. But you should think about it. And we're going to talk more about it. I look away. Leonard doesn't speak, just lets it sit there. I turn back. Speak. What time's the concert? The opening band is at 7, but they're no good. They don't rock like a good band should rock, so fuck 'em. We should show up at around 8:30.
You want us to meet you here?
Who you bringing?
My friend Erin.
Good. I like Erin. She dresses well, speaks well, has a nice smile and a nice laugh. I'll pick you up at 7:30 at your apartment.
I stand. See you then.
Think about it, my son.
I walk home and I take a shower. I hang out with Julianne. She has a beer and I have a cola. I let her talk, listen to her talk. Even though her accent has become familiar, I still love to listen to it. Erin shows up a little early. She has a beer. We wait for Leonard, who arrives at exactly 7:30. We walk out of the apartment. There's a large black limo waiting at the curb, a uniformed driver standing near the open rear door. I look at Leonard, speak.
Black?
He speaks.
Yeah, black.
I thought you only drove white cars.
There's an exception to every rule, and the exception to that rule extends to limousines, because white limousines are silly.
I laugh. We get into the limo and the driver closes the door behind us. There's a fridge stocked with cola and champagne, a television, a stereo. Leonard and I drink cola. Erin drinks champagne. And we listen to music by the band we're going to see as we drive out to the venue. When we get there, we're waved into a reserved parking area, and we're led to our seats, front and center, by a representative of the band. The show starts, and the singer, who may be an asshole in his life, rocks the fucking house once he's on stage. I rock with him, and Erin rocks with him. Leonard rocks with him. We rock and fucking roll all night. Live it, love it. I think about leaving. I think about Lily. I think about my life and what I want from it. I think about these things as I walk, as I work, as I eat, as I shower, as I read, while I'm on the phone, when I'm with my friends. My last thoughts before I sleep. My first thoughts as I wake. I think about leaving here. I sit before her. I sit and I stare at the stone, at her name, at the dates of her life. At the words, you were loved. At the words, you were loved. I sit before her and I remember the first time we met. She smiled and said hello. We were standing in line at the clinic medical unit and she turned around and she smiled and she said hello. I remember our first cigarette. She said, "Wanna smoke, tough guy?" and she laughed at me. I remember the first time we were alone. She came upon me in the woods. I was broken and she held me and said, "You'll be okay. You'll be okay." And as long as she held me, I was okay. I remember our first kiss, the way she tasted, her breath, the smell of her skin, the way my heart beat, beat, beat. I remember every minute of our time, every minute spent hiding from people who told us we shouldn't be together, every conversation, every kiss. I remember her eyes, those beautiful blue eyes like deep water. I remember staring into those eyes and knowing. I remember how her hand felt, small and fragile and stronger than I thought it could be. I remember her hair, long and black, a beautiful mess. She used to hide it from the world with a baseball cap. I remember her smooth, cold, pale skin like marble, the way my hands felt as they moved around it. I remember the scars on her wrists I thought were behind her. I remember crying with her and for her and because of her. I remember laughing with her and for her and because of her. I remember the peace I knew with her. The security I knew with her. The strength I knew with her. The hope I knew with her. The love I knew with her. I knew love with her. Love like nothing before it. We had dreams, plans. We were going to spend our lives together. We carried each other through blackness, and I thought through death, and I was wrong. She did what she did. I don't hate her for it anymore. I'm going to do what I'm going to do. I start to cry. Some of the tears are sadness and sorrow. Some are pain and rage. Some are for loss. Some for forgiveness, and some of them, the best of them, are because I am fortunate to have known her at all. I lean toward the stone where she lies, and I cry, and I whisper, I love you, Lily. And I'll be back to see you. I love you. I'll miss you, and I'll be back. I stand and I walk away. It's time to go. Los Angeles. My second friend with the name Kevin lives in Los Angeles. He's an actor who lives in a Hollywood apartment and takes acting classes and goes to auditions and waits tables and struggles. We went to college together. He's 26 but looks 18. He has dark wavy hair and blue eyes and big rosy cheeks. He likes to talk, and he's funny most of the time, and he's easy to be with most of the time, and he wants to drive with me from Chicago to Los Angeles. It'll be good to have him. He comes to Chicago, and we pack up my truck and plan our route. We're going to cut straight across the Midwest, head south into New Mexico, across Arizona, Nevada, and California. We leave early the next morning. As we pull out, I stop at a random corner in a run-down neighborhood. I take my bottle of Rose, the bottle I bought when I arrived, the bottle I've had during my entire time here, the bottle I've always kept as an option. And I leave it unopened on the corner. I hope somebody finds it, and I hope they enjoy it. We drive straight west through hours and hours of farmland. Hundreds of miles blend together in a sea of gently waving green and yellow. Every red barn, white farmhouse, gray silo looks the same. We stop in Kansas City for the night, get up early, keep going. In Colorado, we cut south, head into New Mexico. Kevin gets a message about an important audition. He needs to be back in LA sooner than planned. We decide to keep going straight to California. We'll stop for gas and food. We'll drive in shifts. One sleeps while one drives. Kevin starts checking the fluids every time we stop for gas. He checks the oil, coolant, wiper. I tell him not to worry about it. That the car was just tuned up and is in good shape. He tells me he's just being careful. We cross the mountains of New Mexico, drop into Arizona. It's 2 in the morning. I pull into a truck stop. I go inside for coffee and cigarettes. Kevin starts checking everything again. 10 minutes later, we pull out. It is the middle of the night. We're in the middle of the desert. Kevin isn't talking anymore. We're both tired. He tells me he's going to sleep. I turn on the radio. I listen to someone talking about stormtroopers who fly around in black helicopters and kidnap and brainwash people who speak out against the government. It's part of a conspiracy controlled by the Freemasons and the Jews. I start to hear a strange ticking coming from the engine. I start to smell burning plastic. I laugh, think maybe the Freemasons and the Jews are after me. The ticking becomes louder, the smell stronger. There is a large boom. The engine immediately loses power. Smoke starts pouring from beneath the hood. The smell is overwhelming. Kevin wakes up and says, "What's happened? What's going on?" I tell him something seems to be wrong with the engine, and I think it has to do with Freemasons and Jews, and I guide the car to the shoulder of the highway. We get out of the car. Kevin is still confused. "What happened?" "I don't know. We've got to get away. I think the car is going to explode." "I think we're okay." "What's wrong with it?" I look at the truck. It is smoking less. It still smells awful. I have no idea. Something bad happened.
How? Did you put all the caps and shit back on?
Of course I did. I'm not stupid.
Just checking.
We stand and stare at the truck. The smoke is almost gone. We stand and stare for a couple of minutes. It is the middle of the night. We're in the middle of the desert. I look at Kevin.
Looks like we're fucked.
Try to start it.
It's not gonna start.
Just try. I get in the truck, try to start it. Loud clicking noises come from beneath the hood. It doesn't start. I get out.
Didn't start.
Maybe if we wait a while.
We wait for 10 minutes. Not a single car or truck passes us. I try to start the engine. Same thing.
Kevin speaks.
What do you want to do?
Sit here.
We sit there. A couple of cars pass by. No one stops. 30 minutes, a state trooper pulls over. An officer gets out of the cruiser. For the first time in my life, I'm thrilled to see a law enforcement officer walking toward me. He asks what we're doing. We tell him the truck broke down. He asks where we're from and going, and I tell him. He asks if we know what's wrong with the truck. I say no idea. He gets back to his cruiser, gets on the radio, speaks for a few minutes, comes back.
I called a mechanic I know who has a tow truck. He can come and get you if you want, but it's not going to be cheap. If you don't want to do that, you can wait till morning and the highway patrol will tow the car.
Can your guy get here faster?
It's the middle of the night and he's not close.
I don't want to wait till morning.
I'll call my guy. He can be here in an hour.
The trooper goes back to the cruiser, gets on the radio. He comes back and tells us the mechanic is coming. He gets back in the cruiser and drives away.
We wait.
I sit on the side of the road and smoke cigarettes. Kevin paces back and forth. He's worried we won't get back in time for his audition. An hour passes. 2 hours. It is starting to get light when we see a tow truck approaching us. It pulls over behind us. A tall, skinny man, his arms covered with tattoos, a cigarette dangling from his lips, gets out of the truck, starts ambling toward us. He speaks.
Looks like you're having some trouble here.
Yeah.
What happened?
Funny noises and smoke.
Pop that hood the fuck up.
I reach in, pop the hood. He opens it, looks at the engine. Kevin and I stand behind him, watch him as he looks around the engine. He turns around.
You're fucked, man. Fucking fucked.
What happened?
Your engine blew up.
How?
Was somebody messing around with it?
I motion toward Kevin. The man speaks.
You've got to put the radiator cap back on and all your coolant evaporated and the thing, boom, blew the fuck up.
Kevin speaks.
Impossible. Nah, that's what happened. I'm looking at it.
I put the cap on.
It ain't there, and as far as I know, they can't take themselves off.
Kevin gets angry, defensive. You're not funny.
I ain't trying to be funny. I'm just trying to tell you what happened. And what happened is there ain't no radiator cap on here, and the motherfucking engine blew.
That's not what happened. I look at the mechanic, speak. How long will it take to fix it?
He thinks for a moment, speaks.
Probably a week, 10 days. Ain't quick, this kind of job.
Kevin speaks.
A week?
At least, man. The engine is fucked. That shit is fucking fried.
Kevin turns to me. I have to be back. I have to be back soon.
I look at the mechanic. Any way to do it faster?
Nope.
Is there a truck rental place nearby?
In Flagstaff.
How far is that?
110 miles or so, or something like that.
Can you tow us there?
I'll tow you to Japan if you fucking pay me, man. I'll tow you anywhere.
How much will it cost?
Well, it's 4:30 in the morning and I fucking hate Flagstaff and my wife don't like me right now and I need some money to make her happy. So it's gonna be pricey.
How much?
$750.
No way.
$500.
$350.
My wife's really fucking mad, man. I need 5 large.
Fine. Let's go.
The mechanic goes back to his truck, pulls it in front of my truck, starts hitching my truck to the towing mechanism on the back of his truck.
Kevin is still angry. Still doesn't believe this is happening. Absolutely doesn't believe he had anything to do with it. I get in next to the mechanic. Kevin is next to me. We start driving toward Flagstaff. We watch the sun rise over desolate flats. The mechanic talks and smokes. He talks about his wife. He says she hates him. About his two brothers. He says they hate him. About his girlfriend. He says she hates him. He talks about his truck. He calls it Wayne. It is his prized possession. He talks about shooting guns in the desert. He's hoping to find someone who will sell him a bazooka so he can do some, he says, real true-to-life destruction-style shit. I listen to the mechanic and laugh for most of the trip. Kevin stares out the window, clenches his jaw, and shakes his head. We pull into Flagstaff. It is still early morning. Almost everything is closed. We find a gas station with coffee and cigarettes and beef jerky. The mechanic drops us with my truck in the parking lot of a truck rental company. I write him a check. He says thank you and advises me to leave Flagstaff as soon as possible. I ask him why. He says strange things happen around here. I ask him what. He shakes his head and says, man, just trust me. There is fucking ugly, scary, whack-ass shit in the air here. He gets in his truck and leaves us. Kevin and I sit and wait. We have 2 hours until the office opens. Kevin spends most of it cursing the mechanic and his faulty diagnosis. When the office opens, I rent a large truck and a trailer, and I push my poor, broken-down truck onto the trailer. We start driving west. I haven't slept in 24 hours. The desert plays tricks with my mind, with my eyes. I see mirages. I see silver flashes, blue lights. I drink coffee, smoke cigarettes, turn the volume on the radio all the way up. Hallucinate. Once we enter Los Angeles County, it takes 4 hours to go 60 miles. When we pull into West Hollywood, I can't think straight, see straight, walk straight. I leave the trucks, my truck on the trailer and the big truck on the side of the street. They take up half a block. I call Leonard. I told him I'd call as soon as I arrived. He wants to have lunch with me. He gives me the name of a restaurant, tells me he'll be there on Wednesday at 1 o'clock. I get a ride to the restaurant. I arrive a few minutes early. I walk inside. The maitre d' is at a stand just inside the front door. I give him Leonard's name. He tells me that Leonard has not arrived. I should wait for him at the bar. I walk to the bar, which is a few feet behind him. I sit down on a stool, look around me. It's crowded, noisy. I am the youngest person in the restaurant and the worst dressed. Most of the customers are middle-aged men in suits. The suits are all gray, black, or navy blue. They look like expensive suits. Most of them are immaculately groomed, perfect hair, smooth tans, manicured hands. Those that aren't look deliberately ruffled, as if they spent the morning in front of the mirror making sure their hair was just the right kind of messy. The walls are covered with cartoon drawings of famous people, almost all men, who are regular customers. Some are movie stars, some athletes, some famous directors and producers. I order a nice, cold, tasty cola, and I wait for Leonard. He arrives 5 minutes later. He's wearing a suit. He's with the snapper, who is also wearing a suit. He sees me, I stand, we hug each other.
Welcome to California, my son.
Thanks, Leonard. We separate. I shake hands with Snapper.
Welcome, kid.
Thanks, Snap. The maitre d' leads us to a table. We sit in a booth along a wall. Leonard and Snap sit on one side, I sit on the other. Leonard speaks.
Here you are in the land of sunshine and dreams. You will either love it or hate it, and you will either flourish or fail.
I'm looking forward to finding out.
Love it, my son, and flourish. Flourish!
What are you doing in town?
I was seeing a nutritionist.
Why?
Because I want to live forever.
I laugh. Seriously?
Yes, seriously. A proper diet may be the key to immortality. I would like to be immortal.
I laugh again. That's crazy, Leonard. Snapper speaks.
That's what I told him.
Leonard speaks.
To each his own.
You really think a special diet will make you immortal?
No, I don't. But I do think it'll keep me here a while longer.
Probably.
definitely. So, now I'm going to see this nutritionist once a week, on Wednesdays, for the foreseeable future.
I look at Snapper. Do you go?
Snapper speaks.
Fuck no. I like cheeseburgers, pizza, fried chicken, ice cream, all the good stuff. I don't care if it kills me, I'm eating it.
I'm with you.
I'll dance on your graves, spin and yelp, and sing happy grave dancing songs.
I laugh. Snapper speaks. If I die, it won't be because of my fucking diet. We all laugh. A waiter comes to our table, says hello to Leonard, says nice to see you again, sir. He gives us menus, we order. I get a ribeye and creamed spinach. Snapper gets a porterhouse, french fries, onion rings, tomatoes and onions, and a blue cheese salad. Leonard orders a chopped salad. As we wait for the food, Leonard asks about Liza. I tell him it's too early to tell. He asks where I'm living. I tell him I'm living at Liza's. He asks about my job prospects. I tell him I may work shitty production jobs while I try to sell the script. He tells me he has friends in Hollywood that will help if I want them to. I tell him I want to do this on my own. The waiter brings Snapper and me steak knives, refills our drinks. As he walks away, another man walks toward us. Snapper sees him, alerts Leonard to his presence. The man is probably in his 50s, but looks older. He has dark, wavy hair. It looks like it's been dyed. He's extremely thin and extremely tan. His skin looks like leather. He's wearing a suit and a sparkling watch and a pinky ring. Snapper looks at Leonard, speaks.
He still owe you?
Leonard speaks.
Yeah, he does.
How do you want to handle it?
I don't want to deal with him. This is not the time or the place.
The man arrives at our table, looks nervous, slightly shaking. He's starting to sweat. He speaks.
Hello, Leonard.
Leonard looks at him, speaks.
It isn't a good time.
I need to speak to you.
It isn't a good time.
I'm sorry about my payments. I really am. I won't miss...
Snapper interrupts. We're having lunch. We would like you to leave.
The man continues. Leonard looks away.
I'm sorry, Leonard. If you could just give me...
Snapper interrupts again.
We would like you to leave.
People at tables near us turn, start watching. Leonard shakes his head. The man continues.
Please, Leonard, please.
I see Snapper reach for his steak knife. The man doesn't see it. He's looking at Leonard, who's looking away.
Boom.
Snapper slams the knife into the table and pulls his hand away. The knife is sticking straight into the table. It's wobbling a bit. The man looks shocked. Snapper stands, towers over him, stares at him, speaks.
It isn't a good time.
Everyone near us is silent, staring. The man's eyes are wide and filled with fear. He turns and walks out of the restaurant. Snapper sits back down, takes the knife out of the table, wipes it with his napkin. Leonard speaks.
That guy's a fuckhead.
Snapper speaks.
Just say the word.
Fuck him. Let's enjoy our lunch.
Snapper chuckles. Someday you'll let me. Our food comes, we eat. Leonard eyes my steak. I offer him some. He says no. After we finish eating, we order dessert. Snapper gets cheesecake. I get a hot fudge sundae. Leonard gets a fruit plate. After dessert, Leonard says, I'll see you next Wednesday. I say, I'll see you next Wednesday. I stay with Liza. We talk for hours. I get along better with her than any woman I've ever met. We laugh and laugh. We sit and talk for hours. As easy as it is to be with each other, and as much as we like each other, there's still something missing. We both feel it, we both know it, there's something missing between us, and we both mourn it. I take my battered truck to get fixed. It's going to take 10 days. I drive around with Liza, start to get a feel for the city. It's a strange city, unlike traditional cities. There is no central downtown. What is called downtown is a ghost town. Empty but for a few high-rise office towers filled during the day. The only residents of downtown Los Angeles are the people who live in a self-governing 10-block area filled with cardboard box houses and tents. The rest of the city is broken into small neighborhoods.
though there is no feeling of neighborhood in them. The sidewalks are empty. People don't interact with each other. There is a feeling that people are living where they are and waiting to move somewhere better, that the dream is almost fulfilled, and when it is, they'll move to one of the wealthy areas of the city and finally make friends with those that live around them. I find a house. It's a 3-bedroom Spanish-style house on a busy street. It stands out among the other houses on its block because the front yard is filled with garbage. I walk around the side of the house, and the backyard is also filled with garbage. I look in the windows of the garage, it's filled with garbage. I look in the windows of the house, also filled with garbage. I ask one of the neighbors what's happening with this house. She tells me no one has lived there for 3 years. Occasionally, a truck comes by and drops off more crap. I go downtown to the city tax office, find out who owns the house, call them. I ask them if they'd be interested in getting the house cleaned up and fixed up. Tell them I'll do it for free if they'll let me live there. The man tells me to meet him at the house later in the afternoon. I meet him. His name is Al. He's a mechanic and inherited the house from his grandmother. He agrees to let me live there. He also wants a small amount of rent, fine with me. I clean the entire house, the yard, the garage. I tear out carpets. There are nice wood floors beneath them. I get a mattress, a desk and a table, somewhere to sleep, somewhere to work, somewhere to eat. I get a roommate. His name is Jalen. I know him from Chicago, where he was a wholesale weed dealer, never selling less than a pound at a time. He says he's through selling weed, that he wants to be a music video director. I go out every night. Go out to bars with my friends. Friends from the old days who have migrated here. All are working in some area of the entertainment industry. We go to the Three of Clubs, The Room, Smalls, Dragonfly, The Snake Pit, Jones, El Coyote. The bars are filled with beautiful young people. It's as if the 3 best-looking people from every town in the country have come to Los Angeles. Everyone wants to be famous. Everyone is well-connected. Everyone is just a step or two away. They're waiting for that break. It's almost there. They can taste it, fucking taste it. I miss Chicago. I miss my friends, miss walking, miss seeing Lily, miss living without ambition. Los Angeles is a lonely city. Everyone is focused on advancement, success, fame, and money. It is hard to adjust to a culture based on always wanting more, on never being satisfied. I'm lonely. I miss my old life. I see Leonard for lunch every Wednesday. He looks thinner and in better shape each time. Snapper and I both eat steaks and multiple side dishes and dessert. Leonard sticks with salad and fruit. I decide I want a dog. I start paying attention to other people's dogs, to their temperaments, to their habits, to their needs, their cost. I meet a pit bull named Grace 2000. Grace 2000 is short and heavily muscled, white with brown patches. She has deep brown, sparkling eyes. She's very excitable, runs in circles around my friend's house, loves to play catch. Sometimes she bites the end of a spring attached to a thick branch of a tree and bounces from it. Sometimes she chases her tail. She never barks and she loves to give kisses. She's a 50-pound ball of energy and love. I decide that I want a dog like Grace. I buy a paper, look in the classifieds, see ad after ad after ad, pit bull, pit bull, pit bull. One of the ads says, Sons of Cholo. I didn't know what Cholo means or who Cholo is, but I like the sound of it, so I call the number and get an address. I start driving. The address is in East Los Angeles, in a working-class Hispanic neighborhood. I park, walk toward the house. There are 2 men sitting on the front porch. They're drinking beer and smoking cigarettes. Their arms are covered with tattoos. I stop in front of them. They stare at me. I say hello. They nod. I ask if they're selling the dogs. They say no habla inglés. I don't speak Spanish, so I hold up the paper. Say, Sons of Cholo. They smile, nod. One of them stands up and motions for me to follow him. We walk around the house. In the backyard, there's a small fenced area. Inside the fence is a small doghouse. The man whistles and a giant pit storms out of the doghouse and starts barking. I've never seen a dog like him in my life. He's short and gigantic, has layers and layers of rippling muscle. His coat is the color of milk chocolate, and he has bright green eyes. His head is huge and thick, as if carved from a block of stone, and it's covered with scars. He stands at the fence and snarls at me. His teeth are huge and a perfect white. I stare at him. He barks and snarls. Looks like he wants to eat me. I am scared to death of him. The man taps me on the shoulder and points and smiles and says, "Cholo, undefeated campeón." He motions for me to follow him. We walk to a garage. He lifts the door and puppies begin streaming out. Adorable little chocolate puppies, small versions of Cholo, minus the scars, minus the snarling. They yip and tumble over each other, jump on my feet, bite at the bottom of my pants. The man points to the puppies and says, "Sons of Cholo." I smile, sit down on the concrete. The puppies run into my lap, start jumping on my chest, licking my face. A hierarchy has been established among them, and the larger puppies start muscling the smaller puppies away. The smallest of them falls off my lap and immediately starts climbing back. He gets pushed off again, starts climbing again. All he wants is to get close enough to lick my face. I stand up. The puppies start nipping at my feet again. I look at the man and point to the smallest puppy. The man nods and holds up three fingers. The price had been listed in the advertisement. I brought cash with me. I take it out of my pocket and hand it to him. He picks up the puppy and hands him to me. We shake hands. He says gracias. I say gracias. I walk toward my car. The puppy starts whining. The further we get from the garage, the louder the whining. When I open the driver's door, the puppy starts crying, looking toward the garage, where the other sons of Cholo are still running around. I sit down in the driver's seat. I brought some puppy toys and puppy treats with me. I hold the little fellow in my lap and try to get him interested in them. He just looks toward the garage and cries. I give up trying to make him stop, and I start the car and I drive away. He sits in my lap on the ride back to my house. He cries and he shakes. He pees on me, pees on the seat, pees on the floor. Son of Cholo is scared to death. And he pees all over me. I call the puppy Cassius. He's a smart pup. He knows his name after a few days. I potty train him in a week. He can sit, shake, stay, lie down in 2 weeks. He goes everywhere with me, rides shotgun in my truck, sleeps in my bed. I go to parties with my friends. We go to apartments, to the courtyards of apartment buildings, to houses in the Hollywood Hills. When I meet new people, the first question they usually ask me is, "What do you do?" I tell them I am an unemployed aspiring writer, and they realize I can't help them in any way, and they can't use me in any way, and they usually walk away from me. I send out my script everywhere, to everyone I meet who might be interested in it. I call them, follow up with them, no luck, no luck. Hearing people say no doesn't bother me, doesn't discourage me. I'm confident in what I can do, and I believe that, to a certain extent, I'm playing a numbers game. If I get myself and my work in front of enough people, sooner or later, someone will like it. I go back to trying to write a book. I spend most of my time staring at a blank computer screen. Jalen and I decide to fill the third bedroom in our house. Figure it'll be good to have someone to share expenses. Jalen brings an old friend from Chicago to the house. His name is Tommy. Tommy is Korean, grew up in a small farm town 40 miles west of Chicago. His father and mother are both doctors. Tommy dresses like a thug and talks like a thug with a thick inner-city accent. He wants to be either a rap star, a DJ, or a rap video director. I ask him if he ever feels like a phony with his clothes and his accent, and he says, "Motherfucker, I grew up in the fields, but my heart's from the motherfucking streets." I ask him if he's ever been in a fight, been arrested, held a gun, or dealt drugs. He says he keeps it real, with a peaceful vibe. I see Leonard on Wednesdays. He is always thinner, always looks healthier. Leonard calls, says it's a big, big day. Round up some friends, I'm taking you to dinner. I ask why it's a big day. He says, I'll tell you when I see you. I ask when and where. He says he'll pick me up at my house, round up some motherfucking friends. I call Liza, Mike, Jenny, Quinn, Mark, my friend Andy, who is visiting from New York. Everyone meets at my house. Leonard arrives in his white Mercedes. Snapper is driving. There isn't enough room in his car, so my friends drive their cars and I ride with Leonard. Leonard has a small briefcase at his feet. I look at it. Speak. That's not for me, is it? Leonard speaks.
You're retired.
Good.
And I want to do this one myself.
Does that have to do with this being a big day?
Indeed it does.
I don't need to know anymore.
You can ask if you want.
I don't want to know.
You can ask.
That's okay.
Really, it's fine. Ask away.
No thanks. Snapper turns around. He wants you to fucking ask him, so ask him. I look at Leonard. Speak. What does that briefcase have to do with the big day? Leonard smiles.
My last truly illegal act.
I laugh. Congratulations. He nods.
It's a big fucking day.
Why are you bringing me and my friends with you?
For a celebration.
Are we at risk?
Of course not.
What's happening?
Ruskies.
Ruskies?
Yeah. The Ruskies have come to town.
So what? Leonard looks at Snapper.
You want to take this one?
Snapper nods. Sure. Leonard looks back at me.
He's taking this one.
I nod. I got it. Snapper speaks. Russians are mean bastards. Have always been mean bastards. They kicked Napoleon's ass, kicked Hitler's ass, kicked every ass they ever encountered. When people like us started coming over here, the Ruskies were in Russia and had no interest. Then the Soviet Union kept them locked up for 70 years. Now those fuckers are free, and they see what we got, and there's fucking hordes of them coming over here, and like I said, they're mean fucking bastards. If I'm a 6 on the mean scale, they're 12s. They're greedy and aggressive, and now that we're legal, I think we just as soon step the fuck out of their way. We can't, however, just step away, because then we look weak and scared, and then we get popped. So we work out a deal. We give them certain considerations that they want. They give us a bag of Russian sparklies that we sell. Everybody wins, everybody's happy, nothing bad happens. We're through with all the illegal rackets we had, and we can't get caught for nothing, except maybe tax cheating. Which might happen, because this is going to be the first year I ever file a tax return, and the IRS notices that shit. You have a good accountant? He laughs. I do. At least I think I do. And I better, or he's in trouble. He chuckles again. Tax return. I'm actually excited about it. I laugh, turn to Leonard. So what's in your briefcase?
Nothing. It's empty.
And you're trading it for one that looks like it, but isn't empty?
You learned well, my son. You were a natural.
I laugh. We turn on Sunset, start heading east, away from the glamour of the Sunset Strip and into the reality of Hollywood. The apartment blocks are lined with decrepit buildings. Because it's night, there are hookers, women who are women and men who are women and some unknown, walking up and down the street, standing in small groups or in corners. They wave and shake their asses and flash their tits and yell at us as we drive past them. Every other shop is a pawn shop. The windows are filled with guitars and amps and drum sets, filled with the dead dreams of rock superstardom. There is a space burger restaurant. Their burgers are out of this world. There is a diner filled with people sitting alone, staring out the window. It's a common sight in Los Angeles. Someone sitting alone, staring out the window. We pull off Sunset. We pull up to a valet in front of what looks like a mosque. It's a large white building with a gold dome. It has spikes along the edges of the roof, iron doors with engraved Arabic words. We get out of the car. Snapper waves off the valet, pulls down the street. I look at Leonard. Speak. What the fuck is this? Leonard smiles.
Belly dance.
Belly dance?
Yeah. Belly dance.
My friends pull up, get out of their cars. They seem to know the place. I ask them if any of them have been here. They say no. Leonard leads us inside. There's a large central room. It's a light room, an open room. There's a fountain in the center of the room, an ornate tile floor. Mosaics cover the walls. There are smaller rooms off the central room, smaller rooms in every direction. They're dark rooms. Thick, dark oriental rugs cover the floors. They're lit by candles. There are people sitting on cushions on the floor. Leonard greets the host, who leads us to one of the smaller rooms. We sit on cushions around a low, circular table. A waiter brings us water and menus. Leonard waves off the menus, orders for the table. Snapper joins us, sets the briefcase near his feet. Leonard introduces himself to my friends, introduces Snapper. He asks them where they're from, why they live in Los Angeles, how they know me. Snapper sits, doesn't speak, occasionally glances toward the entrance to our room, occasionally glances at his watch. A first round of food is delivered. It comes on large round plates. The plates have sections for meats, lamb and beef, thick flat bread, dark heavy sauces. None of us knows what it is or how to eat it. Leonard tells us it's Persian. We eat it with our hands. Just dip the bread with the meat into the sauces. Don't worry about the mess. Don't worry about manners. The food is rich, strong, spicy. My friends drink beer. I drink water. As we finish the plates, I see Snapper nod to Leonard. They both stand with the briefcase. Leonard excuses them. They leave the room. Our plates are taken away. We wait. Our drinks are refilled. We wait. Liza asks if I know where Leonard is. I say I have no idea. Mark asks if we should order more food. I say I'm pretty sure it's covered. More food arrives. It never stops. We wait. I think about going out to find them, to make sure everything is okay. I laugh at myself. Know I'd last about 5 seconds against some mean fucking Ruski. I think about going to speak with the host. I hear a bell. Multiple bells. Moving toward the entrance to our room. Above the bells, I hear Leonard laughing, saying, woo-hoo, woo-hoo, saying, shake it, shake it, shake it. Everyone at the table turns toward the entrance. A belly dancer, in a traditional belly dancing outfit, her hips wiggling, her stomach gesticulating, cymbals on her fingers clashing, clashing, comes shaking into the room. She is followed by another dancer, who is followed by Leonard, hooting and laughing, who is followed by a man with a guitar, frantically strumming, who is followed by two waiters with giant trays of food, who are followed by a smiling Snapper carrying a briefcase identical to the one he was carrying when he left the room. The belly dancers start moving around the table. The waiters set the trays on the table, start unloading heaping bowls of rice and platters with stacks of kebabs, beef, lamb, and chicken. Leonard follows the dancers, pretending to be one of them, making a complete fool of himself, knowing he's doing it, laughing. Snapper sits back down, smiles. My friends eat, drink, watch the show, laugh. Leonard sits and picks at a chicken kebab. He says, I'm watching my weight, has the dancers start dancing again. Whenever I look at Snapper, he nods and smiles. Two or three times he mouths the words, tax return, oh yeah, tax return, oh yeah. We stay at the restaurant for hours, eating more, drinking more, listening to music, watching the dancers, laughing, laughing, laughing. It's all legal now. Snapper is going to file a tax return. The phone rings, I pick it up. Leonard speaks.
My son, my son, my son.
I laugh. Hi, Leonard.
How you doing?
I'm good. You?
I'm very upset with myself.
Why?
I forgot to give you the secret.
What secret?
The secret to kicking ass in dumb shit Hollywood.
You know it?
Of course I fucking know it.
I laugh again. What is it?
Be bold.
Be bold.
But not bold. Be fucking bold.
Okay.
Every time you meet someone, make a fucking impression. Make them think you're the hottest shit in the world. Make them think they're gonna lose their job if they don't give you one. Look them in the eye and never look away. Be confident and calm. Be fucking bold.
That sounds more like the secret to kicking ass in life.
It is. But I was gonna wait and tell you that some other time.
Liza and her friend Mitch find a play they want to make into a short film. They ask if I want to direct it. I say yes. Liza convinces the famous director she works for to fund half of it. Her friend Mitch convinces the famous producer he works for to fund the other half of it. I'm not sure I'm a director. I have no real experience with actors and don't really know how a camera works. But I pretend to be one. And pretending seems to be all that matters in Hollywood. Pretend to be something. Be convincing. And people will treat you differently. As if you actually are what you are pretending to be. It's a game. Embarrassing and fake. But it is a means to an end here. So I play the game. And I quickly learn that I play it pretty well. Tommy and Jalen decide they're going to be DJ partners. They pool all of their money and they buy 2 turntables, a sound system, and several crates of records. They stop working. Spend all of their time smoking weed and spinning records. Cassius grows and grows and grows. At 4 months, he weighs 30 pounds. At 5, he weighs 40. At 6, he weighs 50. The weight is all muscle. His coordination lags behind his growth, so he stumbles and trips and seems confused by his own size. I start to sleep again. I get used to going to bed without the rumbling and shaking of the L train. I go to meetings with development executives. I go to meetings with agents. Development executives are people who read scripts, hire writers to write or rewrite scripts. Agents are the people who arrange for the jobs and negotiate the deals. The meetings are general meetings, which means we say, "Hello, nice to meet you." They tell me they've heard great things about me. I tell them the same thing, and we spend the next hour kissing each other's asses. I try to make an impression with everyone I meet, follow Leonard's advice, speak simply and directly, and look everyone in the eye. Part of me hates going to the meetings. They're fake and stupid, and I feel insecure after each of them. Part of me knows I need to, and I have to, if I want to work and make money. Part of me is happy that I'm doing something other than making deliveries, working a bullshit job, or going for walks. It feels good to actually do something. Tommy and Jalen start throwing parties at our house. They set up the turntables in our living room and charge $10 to walk in the door. The parties start at midnight and end sometime near dawn. The parties keep me awake. I can't fucking sleep. We finish the movie. Liza and Mitch want to have a screening and a party. The studio where they work has a theater. They convince the man who runs it to let us use it. I tell my parents, who I talk to once a week or so, they want to come to the screening. Liza and Mitch send out invitations. They say there's going to be a crowd of people at the screening, actors and directors and writers and agents and managers and producers. Most of them, Liza tells me, will be coming to see if they like my movie and want to work with me. I ask her how they know about me. She tells them that she and Mitch have big mouths. I thank her. Thank him. The days leading up to the screening drag. I'm nervous. If it goes well, I'll get work. If it goes poorly, I'll be forgotten. I feel good about the movie, but I also know it's not going to change the world. If I fail, I fail. I've been through worse. My parents arrive. They recently moved from Tokyo to Singapore. The trip to Los Angeles took 26 hours. I pick them up at the airport. They're tired. I tell them I'll take them to their hotel. They want to see where I live. I tell them I'll take them to their hotel. On our way, we talk. I ask them how the adjustment to Singapore has been. My mom says it's a much easier place to live than Japan. Everyone speaks English and they don't hate foreigners. My dad says it's no different for him. An office is an office. They ask about Los Angeles. I tell them it's fine, I'm getting used to it. They ask about my friends here. They know them from before. I tell them they'll see my friends tonight. It's good to see my parents. It's easier than I expected it might be with them. Our relationship has been strained and difficult for most of my life. Now it gets better and more healthy each time I see them. I know they love me, they always have. I know they want the best for me, they have always tried. It's good to have them here. I drop them off at the hotel. I go home, smoke cigarettes, listen to Tommy and Jalen practice. They sound worse than when they started. None of the beats match. The transitions from song to song are obvious and clunky. Time is slow, as it always is when I want it to be fast. I have nothing to do but wait. I sit in my room, can't think or talk on the phone because of the noise. If I make some money because of this movie, I'm going to buy a bomb and blow those motherfucking turntables to bits. I take a shower, put on some nice clothing. The same clothing I used to wear when I was working for Leonard and was pretending to be a commuter. I laugh at the clothes. They're dusty from lack of use. I brush them off. I leave the house, drive to the hotel, pick up my parents. We drive to the studio, pull up to the gate. Our names are on the proper list. The guard waves us through. We park, start heading toward the theater. My mom and dad look around as we walk. Studios are large, bland, ugly places. The one we are on consists of a couple hundred acres of land, dotted with what look like airplane hangars, a few simple office buildings built to look like houses, and a big, ugly black tower. There is an amusement park attached to the studio where tourists pay for the privilege to be driven around the studio in long, funny buses that look like giant golf carts. There are trucks and trailers parked outside of the hangars. Casually dressed young people walk, ride bikes, or drive golf carts. They all look like they're in a hurry. The tourists all stare at them, hope one of them is a star that they recognize from TV or the movies. My mom asks where all the stars are. I tell her I don't know, I've never seen one. My dad asks what everyone is doing. I say most of them are pretending to be busy so they don't get fired. We get to the theater. Liza and Mitch are standing outside. I introduce them to my parents. I take my parents inside and find them seats. People are starting to arrive. I'm too nervous to sit down. I find Liza. We walk around the back of the theater and smoke cigarettes. 5 minutes before the screening is supposed to start, we walk back to the front. There is a small crowd of people at the entrance, a few that I know. Most I have never seen. Liza goes to talk to Mitch. I stand at the edge of the crowd, wait for everyone to go inside. When they do, I follow them. I stand at the door, wait for the lights to go out. I don't want anyone to see me. I'm nervous, much more self-conscious than I expected to be. When the lights are out, and just before the movie starts, I slip in, walk to the back row, sit down. I don't watch the movie. I watch people watching the movie. I watch their reactions. Hope for laughs when laughs are supposed to come. Hope to move them when I want to move them. Hope I make them happy, sad, curious, hopeful. The reactions are fine. Not great, not bad. Though I doubt anything aside from being carried out on the shoulders of a cheering audience would have made me happy. The movie ends, the crowd claps. I stay in my seat in the back row while people file out of the theater. When they're gone and I am alone, I stand and I walk out. My parents, Liza, Leonard, and a blonde woman with Leonard are waiting for me. They all hug me, congratulate me, tell me it went great, tell me they're proud of me. We walk to the party, which is at a nearby restaurant. As we walk, I meet the woman with Leonard. Her name is Betty. She's tall, thin, probably in her 40s, but looks younger. She's wearing an expensive white silk suit and large diamond studs in her ears and a Cartier watch. I shake her hand. It's soft. She smiles easily and often. We arrive at the party. It's crowded. Leonard finds a table for himself and Betty and my parents. I walk around, thank people for coming. Occasionally, I stop by the table. I hear bits and pieces of conversation. I hear Leonard talking to my parents. He says, I see him every week, he's doing great. I hear him say, I'm legit now, no more danger, no more illegality, I'm 100% legit. I hear him say to my father, I have a bunch of idiots working for me, complete and total idiots. I hear him say, it'll be great, I'll pay you a fortune, and you can live wherever you want, anywhere in the world. I watch my parents and Leonard and Betty from across the room. Leonard and my father look like they're engaged in a serious conversation. My mom and Betty are laughing and smiling. It's strange to see. My mom and Dad and my criminal friend from rehab and his girlfriend sitting at a table together. Fucking strange. At the end of the night, I have a stack of business cards. People who said, "Great work, give me a call and maybe we can do something together." My jaw hurts. I'm not used to talking so much. I don't like talking so much. I'm glad this is over. It seems to have been a success. I find Liza and Mitch and thank them, thank them, thank them. I find my parents and Leonard, tell them it's time to go. We leave. We walk to the cars. We are all parked in the same place. I thank Leonard for coming. He tells me he's proud of me. I tell Betty it was nice to meet her, that I hope we see each other again. She says the same thing to me. They get in Leonard's car and drive away. My parents and I get in my car. I start driving them to their hotel. My father speaks. "Your friend Leonard is an interesting fellow."
"Yeah, but you knew that already."
"You know what he was talking to me about?"
I'm scared to ask.
My mom starts laughing.
"What's so funny, Mom?"
She shakes her head, giggles.
"What did he say?"
"He wants me to come work for him."
I laugh. "Speak.
What's he want you to do?"
"Work for his phone company."
I laugh again. "You gonna do it?"
"I'm actually tempted."
"No way."
My mom speaks.
"You should have heard his offer."
"An offer you couldn't refuse?"
My dad laughs. Speaks.
"He said he stopped making those."
"Yeah.
So what was it?"
"A huge amount of money for 6 to 12 months of work."
"Really?"
My mom speaks.
"It was a crazy amount of money."
"Why only 6 to 12 months?
My dad speaks.
"He wouldn't say."
"What would you do?"
"He wouldn't say that either."
"Did he say anything?"
"That he needed someone he could trust, who was outside of his organization and had extensive international business experience."
"That's weird."
My mom speaks.
"He's not exactly normal, James."
I chuckle.
"Yeah."
I drop them off at their hotel. Leonard calls my dad again the next day. Says he would really love my dad to reconsider his offer. My dad says, "No thank you, Leonard, though I appreciate you thinking about me." I spend the next 2 days with my parents. We go to the beach, walk around Beverly Hills, eat at nice restaurants. I take them to my house when Jalen and Tommy aren't there. They both think it sucks. When they say it, I laugh. It's a good 2 days. It gets better with them every time we see each other. I take them to the airport. My mom cries, tells me how proud of me she is. My dad tells me to keep it up. I call the people who gave me their business cards. Some of them take my calls, some of them don't. Some of them say they like the movie. Some of them dance around saying anything about the movie. Tommy and Jalen run low on funds, can't afford weed anymore, so they start growing it in our backyard. Leonard cancels our Wednesday lunch once, twice, three straight times. He doesn't tell me why, just calls and says he can't make it. I send my script to a dozen people, 2 dozen people. I call them, follow up with them. A few of them like it, a few of them don't like it. Nothing happens either way. Cassius keeps growing. It's shocking how fast he's growing. He still goes everywhere with me, rides shotgun in the truck, sleeps in my bed. Though he now looks like a large, menacing pit bull, he is a baby, baby, baby. He loves to give kisses, play tug of war, chase a ball. He'll do anything for a treat. He's a huge, muscle-bound baby. I take a job working as a production assistant. It's shitty work. I drive around all day running errands for an asshole director who thinks he's saving the world with a shaving cream commercial. Leonard cancels a fourth time, fifth time, sixth time. I wonder if something bad is happening or if he's just busy. When I ask him, he says he can't talk about it yet. He'll tell me when he can. Tommy and Jalen start selling the weed they're growing. They figure it's easier than working. Our phone rings constantly. There's a steady stream of people in and out of the house, dull-eyed, slow-speaking, potato-chip-eating people. A producer calls. He read my script, says he loves it. I've heard this before, heard producers say they love it, and I never hear from them again. I ask him if he's going to blow smoke up my ass or actually do something. He says he wants to buy it and make it. I ask him how much. He gives me a number. I say, fucking sold, my friend. It is all yours. Cassius and I move out. My new house is in Laurel Canyon, which is a small neighborhood in the Hollywood Hills. There is one road into the canyon. The road is off Sunset. It is a two-lane road that twists, turns, and is lined with huge overhanging trees and walls of rock. Houses built on stilts dot the rock. Once you're into the canyon, there are two roads that lead up further. The first road sits at a small intersection. There's a stoplight, a convenience store, a pizza place, and a real estate office. The second road is several hundred yards up. There is a stoplight and the ruins of a stone mansion. The canyon is heavily wooded with pines, oaks, maples, and cypress. It doesn't look like the rest of Los Angeles. It's cool, dark, and quiet. More like a forest than a city. I live in a small house at the top of the first road. My house is pink stucco. It has two bedrooms, a bathroom, a kitchen, a living room. It has a small backyard that is dug out of the side of a hill. Three cement walls hold the hill back and enclose the space. I don't have much furniture, a mattress and a desk. I buy a futon and a television and a stereo. My neighbors are friendly, say hello. I recognize one of them as a drummer for a heavy metal rock band. There's always noise coming from his house. I recognize another as a famous female porn performer. There is always noise coming from her house. The couple next door are in their 30s. She's an actress. He's a composer. They're a brand of hippie found only in L.A. They drive a Mercedes but say things like groovy, far out, and dig it, man, dig it hard. Cassius and I are happy here. We have a mellow life. I go back